Hello, everyone. Excuse my sick voice. I'm just hopping in here to make a correction. It has been brought to my attention that I said 1977 when her birthday was 1997. So I do apologize for that. She was 1 month shy of turning 16, so she was still 15 at the time she went missing. And additionally, her mother's name was Christine, not Alice. In the documentary I watched, they said Alice for confidentiality reasons, but the private investigator advised me that that was incorrect. Thank you guys, and enjoy the episode.
This episode contains graphic details of murder and other crimes. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Not Always Polite. Hope you guys had a good week. If you follow me on social media, or if you live in Canada, or even anywhere else in the world, I guess it's been pretty big news. I'm sure you've heard about the terrorist attack that happened in London, Ontario this past Sunday. A Muslim family was killed in a horrific act of, I guess I should say alleged, so I don't get fucking sued or something. Alleged terrorism, which resulted in 4 out of 5 family members and 3 generations of the family being killed on the sidewalk when this 20-year-old fucking idiot, I don't even want to say his name because he's the literal scum of the earth, he drove his truck up on the sidewalk, ran over the grandmother, the mom, and the dad, and their 15-year-old daughter, and left the 9-year-old son in critical condition. So he lost his mom, his dad, his grandma, and his sister all at once because this monster decided that he was going to run them over because they were Muslim. And I don't know how much I can share about this. There's a publication ban on his trial I saw, so there's probably not going to be a ton of information out there until afterwards. But regardless, I went to the vigil that was held at the mosque on, what day was that? Wednesday, maybe? I don't remember. But I went to the mosque. There was like thousands of people there. The prime minister was there. A lot of politicians, which I wasn't a huge fan of. But if you're interested, Jamit Singh, I probably pronounced his name wrong, the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, he had an amazing speech. He said it like it was. I really appreciated the words of the family friends that were there. The MC, she did such a good job. But if you are interested in learning more about that case, definitely look it up. It was really tragic. So my thoughts and prayers go out to those affected, including the first responders, the people on scene that tried to help. Like, it was just really devastating. So if you're interested in more information, please check out my Instagram. There are lots of ways to donate to the family. But yeah, so I wanted to touch on that before I got into today's episode. So today I am going to be talking about the missing persons case of Megan Pelon. So we're going to take a little trip up north to Sudbury, Ontario. Sudbury is the largest city in northern Ontario, and in 2016 the population was about 160,000. The city is known for being a mining town. Prior to 1883, the land was inhabited by the Ojibwe people of the Algonquin group for thousands of years until the discovery of nickel and ore during the construction of the Transcontinental Railway. Unfortunately, like many other cities, not only in Ontario but around the world, they are experiencing a major opioid crisis. So in 2018, the Sudbury police reported an overall crime rate 38% higher than the provincial average and 3% higher than the national average. So definitely not the safest place to live, but you know. So Megan, let's get to know Megan a little bit. Megan was born on October 6th, 1977, making her 23 years old at the time of recording. According to the website missingkids.ca, Megan is 5'10", 140 pounds with black hair and hazel eyes. She has a tattoo of a Playboy bunny on her left shoulder and a scar above her right lip. To say Megan had a perfect life would be a stretch. Megan grew up primarily with her father, Mark Pilon, and her grandmother. Her mother, Alice, passed away when Megan was 6 due to an overdose on prescription painkillers. In an interview with Investigation Discovery, Mark, her father, says that Alice was bipolar and had an addiction to OxyContin. In the same interview, her aunt Ellen states that not having her mother around was very difficult on Megan. When Megan reached her teenage years, her father said that him and her started to argue and she would storm out of the house. He also says that she was starting to show signs of drug addiction that he had previously seen in her mother. Mark was frustrated trying to be a single father to a defiant teenager. Meanwhile, he was struggling with his own battles. He suffered with depression and he had chronic back pain. Just before Megan went missing, Mark went in for an elective surgery to try to help with his back pain. At this time, Megan was 16 years old. They were living together, and she had brought home a stray cat without asking him first. But because he was scheduled to go to the hospital for surgery, Mark agreed to let Megan keep the cat, thinking it might keep her company during his extended stay in the hospital. Instead, the little cat named Bella became comfort to Mark during Megan's mysterious absence. Every day at Bella's feeding time, Mark makes his daily visit to his daughter's bedroom. So he hasn't touched it since she's been gone, essentially. All of her posters are still up in the room. I saw in a documentary that she had, like, Cody Simpson, Justin Bieber, you know, all the, like, 2013 icons. Megan was last seen on September 11th of 2013. The last time that Mark saw Megan, he was still recovering from back surgery, but despite that, he could tell something wasn't right with her. Quote, "She was not herself that day. I think she was on some kind of weird drugs," he said in an interview with Toronto.com. Quote, "We didn't have much of a conversation. She came into my hospital room, said hi and bye and I love you. She only stayed for maybe a minute, and then she left and got into a vehicle I'd never seen before. That was the last time I saw her." Mark later stated that she was seen getting into, like, a dark green muscle car, but that was all he could see. So all that weekend after Megan's visit on Friday, Mark said he called her dozens of times trying to track her down. When a friend that he had sent to check on Megan on Monday reported their house had been trashed and Megan was nowhere to be found, Mark decided to call the police and report her missing. So in amongst all of the mess in the house, they did notice that Megan had left her ID and her debit card behind. In the same ID documentary, the big narrative that they portray is that Megan was dating older men. She was on explicit websites like Plenty of Fish, and just generally putting herself into situations that could end badly for her. Remember, she was only 16 at this time. So obviously, her one friend said that she was dating a guy that was like 30 or something, which is definitely a little suspicious. So according to Sergeant Jordan Buchanan, quote, "The trust of the investigation after that episode of Last Seen Alive aired was in the direction of human trafficking, but we have no information from across Canada in any of the projects that have involved human trafficking, nor have we followed up on any tips that have proven fruitful that Megan Pilon is being human trafficked. I don't promote that as the reason she's missing or that I even have a belief at this point as an investigator in an investigation that she is currently being human trafficked." So, The Last Seen Alive is that documentary I was talking about on Investigation Discovery. The whole plot of that documentary was basically that she was being prostituted out or taken into human trafficking or whatever, but essentially Sergeant Buchanan was like, we looked into that and we didn't really see anything. So, again, in that documentary, the private investigator talks to a woman called Wyona, who was rumored to be Megan's pimp, but they talk to her and essentially nothing comes from it and the trail kind of goes cold. So Sergeant Buchanan says, quote, "At this point, we are concerned that because of the length of time that has gone by, foul play may be involved. Our hope that is that we find Megan one day, but after this length of time, a person of her age who has not been located, it begins to look very bleak. I have high concerns that it will not be a good outcome. Her father, Mark, said to Toronto.com, quote, "She fell in with the wrong crowd. There's a good possibility that she overdosed or something like that, so I don't know if she's still alive anymore." In another YouTube video, Mark says that maybe she overdosed and the people that she was with just, like, buried her body to not get in trouble. So, Mark also noted that most of his hopes for a happy ending were dashed when Megan failed to come home to claim a $12,000 inheritance from her mother when she turned 18, and when her grandmother passed away, she didn't go to her funeral. So, if anyone has information about Megan's disappearance or her whereabouts, is urged to call the Greater Sudbury Police Service at 705-675-9171 or contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. This case is still open and being investigated, so please, if anyone knows anything, like I say all the time, you never know, even the smallest detail might be important, so please, if you know anything, you can even go online. Crime Stoppers has a website, www.222tips.com. Oh, and one more thing before I go. I did also want to touch on, I don't know a lot about this. I should probably look into it, but the bodies that were found on an old site of a residential school, 215 children, is absolutely heartbreaking. So please, if there's any way that you can get involved, share the posts, reach out to people in Parliament. Like, the flags at half-mast are great, but clean drinking water on the reserves would make a much bigger impact. With all that being said, I hope you guys have a great weekend and a good rest of your week next week. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram and Twitter at NotAlwaysPolite. And if you feel so inclined, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I would highly appreciate it. Yeah. Have a good weekend, guys. I will see you next week. Bye. Hello everyone and welcome back to Not Always Polite. I hope you guys had a great week last week. As you can probably tell, I'm still sick. We're doing better, but not 100% there yet. So again, I apologize for my crusty voice, but it is what it is. We're gonna do it anyways. Today I have an unsolved disappearance of a child. This is the case of Lonnie Philip Bordeaux. And I'll just get right into it. Lonnie Philip Bordeaux was born on September 15th, 1970, to his parents Elmer and Linda in Ottawa, Ontario. He was said to be very bright and high-spirited. He had an IQ of 116 at the age of 6. I'll be honest, I don't really know a lot about IQs, but the fact that they said it probably means that it's important. And by they, I mean the True Crime Diva blog that I read this from. And read it. Anyways. So Lonnie's parents ended up divorcing in 1975, and his dad got primary custody of 5-year-old Lonnie and his sister, Lori. Their mother, Linda, had weekend visitation. 2 years later, Elmer met a woman with 3 children of her own from a previous relationship, and she soon moved in with Elmer and the 2 kids. Lonnie didn't get along with her at all, and his behavior started to take a turn. His father was able to find a couple named Mel and Pam Spallin through the Children's Aid Society to watch him while he worked during the day. I'm not sure what caused the mother to not get full custody or why Elmer didn't want her to have custody of him instead while he was working, but anyways. About halfway through 1977, the Spallins had temporary full-time custody of Lonnie. The family court eventually decided that Lonnie and Lori needed to be reunited with their mother. During a Christmas visitation that same year, Linda had noted that Lonnie seemed hyperactive.
She immediately asked for and was granted custody of both children. Elmer objected to this arrangement, stating that the girlfriend with whom Lonnie did not get along with had moved out of the house and broken up with him. At this time, Children's Aid Society threatened him with legal action if he tried to interfere with the mother taking over custody. Lonnie was still unhappy under the care of his mother, telling her that he really wished that she and his father would get back together, but she told him that that would never happen. I feel like this is something that a lot of children of divorce can resonate with, so I do feel for Lonnie. CIS decided to assign counselor Dave Plummer to help deal with Lonnie's issues. Although it took a few months, Lonnie began to open up to Dave and his behavior improved. However, a few months later, he started to get jealous when his sister would go with him to visit his father. Not just his father, their father, sorry. Elmer then had separate visitations with each child, thinking that would make things better, but it ended up leading to Lonnie being upset that Lori was having alone time with their father. Elmer said he wanted to spend more time with Lonnie due to his tantrums, but it never seemed to be enough. In 1980, Lonnie was placed into a group home for kids his age for 6 months, after which he went back to live with his mother. He seemed to be better adjusted and his behavior improved, but again, it was short-lived. He began attending grade 4 at Assumption Separate School. The curriculum there was half French, half English, which was a struggle for him, and he had a hard time making friends. This caused his behavioral issues to resurface. In late January of 1981, Lonnie argued with his father about how much time they spent together. Elmer said he would no longer spend any time with him if he didn't get his attitude in check. A few days later, Lonnie tied a rope around his waist and lowered himself out the bedroom window. He was found by Van Air police 4 hours later at a movie theater about 2 miles from their home. Elmer spoke to Lonnie immediately after the police picked him up, and his son never gave any indication that he would do such a thing again. But that being said, he also didn't give any indication that he wouldn't do that again. So, at this time, Lonnie is 10 years old. Keep that in mind. The following day at 6:30 p.m. on February 5th, 1981, Lonnie asked his mother if he could watch TV in the basement. 15 minutes later, he was gone and never seen again. Linda apparently told the police shortly before the disappearance that Lonnie watched a film called, quote, The Prince of Central Park, about a pair of siblings who run away from home and live in a tree in New York's Central Park. Lonnie said, quote, that looks neat. As one can imagine, given Lonnie's runaway attempt literally the day before, the immediate assumption by both authorities and his parents was that he had run away again. The theory that police and Lonnie's mother believe is that Lonnie crawled out through the basement window and ran away again. However, it did not appear that he took any belongings with him. Linda thought that maybe Lonnie had hitchhiked to his father's home in Carlton Place, about 50 kilometers away. Authorities were positive that Lonnie was staying with friends in town, but refused to say how they knew that. His friends said he was probably sleeping under apartment stairwells, but the police searched several apartment complexes and found nothing. Officers believed Lonnie would safely return within 24 hours. Remember, this kid's like 10. Maybe 11. No, he's 10 at this time. So he's 10 years old. Police claimed that Lonnie was, quote, streetwise, and had been spotted panhandling for food on Rideau Street a few days after his disappearance. Authorities said the boy knew how to panhandle and shoplift. However, Plummer contradicted the police and said Lonnie didn't know how to do either. He did have a high IQ, so he might know how to do that, but it's not like he had experience doing those things, if you know what I mean. So there were several alleged sightings of Lonnie, including one at St. Lawrence Shopping Center, but police could not confirm any of them. Lonnie was a typical-looking boy with blonde hair. Whoever the witnesses had seen could have been any blonde male around the same age. Linda Bordeaux released a letter asking for her son to return home and included a message to friends, quote, if you're his friend, please be a good friend and help Lonnie face his problems and not run away from them. But Lonnie's friends were loyal to him and said that they would not report it to police if they did see him because they knew Lonnie didn't want to go home, which is very interesting. Police checked several leads, but they could not find Lonnie, and apparently he kept eluding them, staying one step ahead of them. If that was the case, authorities publicly acknowledged that the 10-year-old boy had outsmarted them. 2 weeks after Lonnie vanished, police ended the search and claimed all of the media attention surrounded Lonnie and kept the boy from returning home. About 3 months after Lonnie's disappearance, police made contact with a girl Lonnie's age. She was able to get word to Lonnie that she wanted to meet him. The girl and an officer converged by the water fountain in the St. Lawrence Shopping Center. At the meetup, she pointed to a boy walking towards them and said, "There he is. That's him coming now." But the boys heard a security guard's walkie-talkie and fled. The police never confirmed if the boy was Lonnie Bordeaux. Both Vanier police and Lonnie's parents maintained that Lonnie had ran away and was alive and safe somewhere. Investigators didn't suspect foul play for even a second. For that reason, they never searched Lonnie's parents' homes or suspected them of any wrongdoing, even though Lonnie and his parents had problems. Linda claimed that she received several mysterious phone calls after her son's disappearance. During the first call, a young male voice asked for Lori, but she wasn't home at the time. Only after Linda hung up the phone did she realize the caller was her son, which sounds pretty sus to me, but anyways. She received subsequent phone calls, but nobody spoke, only silence on the other end. She and the police believed that the caller was Lonnie, but the police never identified the person. Lonnie's mother and father never wavered from their runaway theory. They didn't even mention the possibility that their son had met with foul play. It is unclear where his parents are today, but by 1986, his mother had moved out of the Vanier home, his father had moved to Ottawa by 1991, and Lonnie's sister Lori had a son in 1985. She would now be in her mid-50s. To this day, Lonnie has never been found. He was last seen wearing a blue and red lumberjack shirt or jacket, I'm assuming that means plaid, a blue V-neck velour sweater with white stripes on the collar, blue corduroy pants, and snowmobile boots. And that is all the information I have on Lonnie's case, but the whole thing is so weird to me. Like, obviously something was going on in that home. And if Lonnie did run away, I feel like the parents know more than they are leading on. Obviously, I have no proof of that, but it just, the whole thing is so suspicious to me. So honestly, I hope that Lonnie simply ran away and started a new life, but I feel like that would be really difficult for a 10-year-old boy. Unless one of his friends helped him and maybe, like, one of his friends' families knew, like, what was going on at home and they let him stay with them. But I have no idea. But anyways, that is today's case. I hope you guys enjoyed. Please follow me on Instagram at notalwayspolite. And if you would be so kind to leave me a review wherever you're listening, I would really appreciate it. Hopefully next week I am feeling much better and I don't sound like a nasally rat, but we shall see. Anyways, I hope you guys have a great rest of your weekend and I will catch you guys next week. Bye.